Fixed. I'm Sam. Got Chris and Jamie here, and very excited to have our guest here today, Nick Gillette. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sam. Great to be here. It's nice to meet you, Jamie and Chris.
Hey.
Nick is a improviser here in Philadelphia, and he has a really cool background, which I'll let him expand upon. But I first saw Nick in a show. He does a duo called the Wadsworth Collective, if I'm getting it right.
The Wadsworth Constant, yeah.
Constant, that's right. And it really reminded me, Jamie, of a lot of the stuff that we were playing around with like absurdity and, you know, playing with nonsense and existentialism. And it was really cool. And then Nick had a show in Fringe this past year, and I went to the audition for it, and he said, it's not going to be that. And it ended up being a much more dramatic show. And so I'm excited for Nick to kind of talk about his different tones and tastes here. But Nick, why don't you, for some of our listeners who might not know your name, give us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, cool, thanks. Yeah, so I guess I can start with just talking about those two projects specifically. I'm based in Philadelphia, and when Kristen Scheer also was, for the last 10 years, we had been doing a monthly show, The Wadsworth Constant, which was an hour long, just a duo, and it was, yeah, very much inspired by Beckett and Ionesco, and just trying to kind of like elevate the look of what we think of for improvised theater. So there was a little bit of consideration around costume and sets, more than just like, you know, show up, kick around, do a show. And a lot of attention paid on sort of what are the themes that we're really driving at, which were mostly like existentialism, the like quiet tragedies of loneliness, the way that like our best intentions are foiled by ourselves. And yeah, all with this eye towards, you know, there's at least one absurd thing in the world that's just like scooped up and eaten as, yeah, that's just the way, this just the way we are, just something different each time. It's been as far as we can tell, a very successful show, a lot of great audience feedback. I'm actually tomorrow hopping on a plane. We're flying to Vancouver. Kristen Scheer now lives in Portland, so the only time we get to do the Wadsworth Constant is at festivals. And we've got, we were offered two shows for the Vancouver Improv Festival. Feels great. And I'm always like super eager to get back on the boards and show more people what exactly it is we do. It's highly physical. Kristen Scheer has a huge like clowning and physical theater background. I am also, I was previously an acrobat, toured around with a company I co-founded called Almanac. And that really informs the work, a lot of like weight sharing and pratfalls and just really using the full stage, not just in a sense of like, you know, walking around and talking, but like, how do we fill a space in a way that means something and that actually furthers the goals or the weird idiosyncrasies of a character. So that's been a long-term project. I feel like there's still a ton of like artistic inquiry inside of that. The other project. Oh, sorry, go on.
Just before you go to the other project, because I love this. This sounds right up our alley, to be honest. Getting on the boards to show them, referencing Ionesco, Beckett. Do you both of you have a theater background?
Yes, very much so. So yeah, Kristen, I think like classically trained. She had been doing Shakespeare by the time I moved to Philly. A lot of different theater projects, but improv was always kind of our wheelhouse in that way. I'm also an actor by trade, but sort of through the like devised theater end of things, which is the Pig Iron School is where I went and got a lot, much of my like clown training. And that's a program built around devised theater. And it was during that is when Kristen and I really put our heads together and thought about, you know, this needn't be, you know, like a full let's, you know, tap the donors and get a budget. And it can be quick and dirty and still as live and infused with all the spiritedness of that as possible.
I have a million things to say. I'm sure you do too. Go ahead, Jamie.
Yeah, I'm just curious because actually Chris and I were just talking about, so this is top of mind when you were talking about elevating, you know, how we think of and look at improv. I love that. Why, I'm going to ask you about the inverse. why is improv so often the butt of jokes? You know,
why is it lame and the butt of jokes on? Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's kind of great that it's like more and more people know about it. It wouldn't be like the butt of jokes in the cultural canon if it weren't. But
do they know about it in the way that we all know about like rollerblading or something? And I did that aggressively, so you know, it was very cool. But like, a lot of people knew about rollerblading, and it was fun to make fun of. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. That's a great question. I don't know. It's on the same level as like, oh, I'm so sorry. I have to apologize. I'm a rollerbladist. It's in me. It's what I do.
I spent a lot of years doing that, Nick. So please.
I think part of it has to do with the accessibility of it. I think there's a ton of hobbyists who are like, this is what they do to blow off steam. You know, they've got the day job and then they, you know, take a 101 class at, you know, wherever. And because the on-ramp is so wide and so welcoming, there's a ton of improv. And so if it's like a pyramidal base of like entry level is super wide, there's a lot of it that people see that is, I think, from a like an objective or like a kind of connoisseurship angle, looks like bad theater, right? Yeah. Feels like a high school production at best. And that's because a lot of people's interest and engagement with it, I think, has nothing to do with really the theater and the show, but rather the experience. I think people really eat up the chance to just like play. And that is, I want to say, like, great, right? In its own context, it is great that people are actively engaged and more people are finding that this is a fun thing to do, right? They're out there on the rollerblading course, you know, cruising around and scraping their knees. Then I think on the other end of things, like there are, I don't know why I'm stuck on the rollerblading example, but like you think like the extreme sports of like people jumping canyons, putting rockets on them, like what can be done with them is a different consideration. I think it's, you know, it's as the pyramid kind of like narrows to the apex of, yeah, like people really treating it professionally as not just like a comedy angle, but a performance art in its own right.
And so who's your audience for that? Either who was your audience? I know that in the festival circuit, it's a little bit different. And are they your ideal audience? Is there a way to set up an expectation for the house to say, you know, this might not be a montage or a herald. It's going to be a little more elevated, which is, you know, we love that. I don't know if Los Angeles is different in that we've mentioned before that it's a showcase town, maybe not a lot of time to pump the brakes and explore. It's more kind of like fast, funny, and that's kind of a generalization. But I'm just curious, you know, who's seeing your shows? Is it students? Is it people off the street?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of nice that when we do have kind of like at least a double like Venn diagram overlap of there are the improvisers who are, yeah, like students of ours who are going out and seeing as many shows as they can. There's the indie teams who have like we've coached in the past, you know, and they'll come forward and be like, we just want to see more. We want more of this. And then there's also like Philadelphia has a really strong devised theater community. And I think people recognize like, oh, yeah, this improv thing is more than just like the like hokey jokey showcase kind of thing. So there's a little bit of a Venn diagram of pulling those two audiences and living right in between them.
I'm going to let Jamie and Sam speak, I promise you. But can you give us a little definition of devised theater?
Yeah. So and my understanding of it comes explicitly through the school I spent. It's a professional program. It's now become an MFA program. They're tied in with University of the Arts. I was the first cohort through there when it was just a certificate program for devised theater, which essentially is theater that's made through improvisation, right? You have an ensemble, you have kind of looser roles than like writer, director, actor. It's more like we trade off who's on the outside. There's an outside eye. We often play in. The dialogue is made in character on our feet. It is how to generate new works of theater by writing, by doing. So maybe there's like a theme we're playing with. Maybe we'll do, yeah, improvisation as exploration. Maybe there's like a scenario like, oh, we know our show needs a scene like this. Let's just get these two characters in. And so I would say devised theater is, yeah, new works of theater that are written on their feet, and that the traditional hats of like who's doing what in the show are a little looser and can be traded back and forth.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's interesting that definition kind of reminds me of, I guess, how Second City talks about improv, where it's really more about using improv to write sketches. And, you know, I think their boundaries are a little bit more linear, but it's been very interesting to see the line of devised theater and improv in the city. And Nick, like, I know a little bit about your background. I know you were a teacher of improv, like you still are a teacher of improv, but can you walk through like the timeline between like your Pig Iron devised theater experience and your improv experience? Like what's the chicken and the egg there? Which came first and how do they inform each other for you?
Yeah, great question. I was definitely an improviser first and still kind of like when I have to like kind of describe myself and what I do, I usually start with like improv first and foremost. There was a point though, I was doing a lot of improv in Philadelphia when I first moved in. I started teaching with the Philly Improv Theater. I then got involved with the burlesque scene, which we didn't know it was called devised theater, what we were doing, but it was like a full, like, here's a 7-piece swing band. Here's like a number of like musical numbers. It was a like giant revue show, like Cabaret Red Light put on some spectacular shows. And yeah, we didn't call it devised theater, but essentially that's what we were doing, right? We would all get together and like write a show, put it together and like on our feet, sometimes the like sloppy live version of it would be, hey, I'm going to try this. We're like backstage, like, I'm going to try this new thing, follow my lead. And everyone's like, yes. And so that was all infused with like doing a ton of like house teams with Fit. There's also the more like polished professional stage shows and burlesque. And I reached a point where I realized, I plateaued, right? I was trying to feel the same moves. And I think this happens to a lot of improvisers who have been in the game for a while, where you start to feel like there's gotta be more to this. And so I decided to take myself seriously and be like, okay, if I'm gonna like quit the day job and become a full-time like professional performing artist, then I gotta invest in myself. And that's when I went back to school. So that was the first year the Pig Iron School opened up. And that was a fantastic experience. I learned all the things I didn't even know I didn't know. And I think it really like upped my game in a way that let me return to teaching improv with this whole new bag of tricks and a very different, much more like clown infused, like somatic approach, a lot out of my head and with a number of tools to give other improvisers and students. Essentially the same tools, right? To teach them like how to return to play, how to return to the like the spirit of the thing inside. I hope that makes sense or answers your question. I feel like I was rambling a bit at the end there.
You're teaching your big dumb fun class again, and I know that was one that's been pretty popular. Can you talk a little bit about what sort of, I think that is a little clown infused, isn't it?
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah. So Big Dumb Fun is a class I teach with Crossroads Comedy. It only comes up about once a year, and it's specifically geared towards students who are a little, I don't know if the word is overtrained, but they start really like chomping at the bit too hard. And they start to get stuck in their ruts. And it's, I mean, a lot of classes I've noticed will bill themselves as like, hey, got to get out of your head. And this is explicitly this. I listened to a Comedy Fix episode that sounded very similar. I forget, Chris or Jamie, if it was one of you teaching a show that, or not a show, a class that is no notes, just play.
Yeah, was that Jamie?
Yeah. And this sounds similar. It's a little bit more like, here's the lesson at the end of the day, but it is purposefully about, it's called Big Dumb Fun. And I think it's accurately named, like how to just like get on stage with a presence that just paints the walls with you as soon as you step out there, to be so like dumb. And I think the type of clown I love best is idiocy style, like idiot style, just like the total like smooth brain, like no concept of what's going on outside of like the one thing that they're that's so important.
Can I ask?
Yeah, we're getting it.
How do you do that? Like, what's the lesson, or what's the one or two sentences that you would tell somebody who wants to play this big, dumb fun? How do you paint the walls with your idiocy? Like, what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, part of it is like a full clown state, like the presence of one of the phrases I like to that I learned and like to repeat is like when you're playing a mask character, to be pushing right up against the mask, right? That just you're alive with breath, your eyes are present and alive and with us in the room. So a lot of it is breath and gaze, just the physical act of like seeing things as if for the first time. But also a lot of interesting physical choices. We just played with last week, Kristen Linklater is a voice coach. Her book, Freeing the Natural Voice, I recommend to any performer. And there's a vowel ladder that's like all of the different sounds a human can make, all the non-social sounds that we typically don't associate with human speech, even just to get get on stage and make a choice that is so outside of your normal civil social. Here I am going to the post office life that you can't help but be brought beyond where you have any expectation of what you should be doing. And you get to outrun the little sensor in our minds. Right. That we all have. Right. That, you know, as soon as you make a choice, the little talking part of your brain that says like, well, that was fucking stupid. And now you have to do that over and over. Good luck with this scene, idiot. Right. Like that's part of that that chatty sensor I think we all have. But so, yeah, a lot of physical tools to think less, play more. And yeah, as far as like the bigness of it, like we play a lot with scale. How big can it be before it stops being believable? Or how big can it be before it like locks into like rigor mortis, right? And it's not actually a playable choice anymore. And yeah, I think it's a good way to call it a laboratory for them, just to be able to like actually experiment and play. And I do have a tendency to kind of like over-explain. And so I'm trying my best to let them just like feel the lessons as they are and like let them reflect back their feelings and explorations inside of some of these tools. And it's, yeah, so far has always felt at the end of the class. It's like you can tell when you like you come out of it and everyone feels like a little more jazzed and alive than the way they came in.
We talk a lot about this idea of whether or not students need to have any training to understand certain concepts, know the rules, to break the rules, so on and so forth. What is your thought on that? I mean, that sounds like such a fun time. Sounds like the class you're talking about would be fun for anybody, but you're right, specifically for the overtrained, they're in a rut, their gears are crunching, they've lost the fun. This sounds like a blast, but I'm curious, is it as satisfying for the person who's just walking up the street? That isn't the question. I guess I'm more just curious about your thoughts. Would you prefer these students have prior training, and is that important?
We require some. I think it, because it is like, for as fun as it is to do and be, it is a performance style, and it is always with the idea that this is for, like, it's for us in the sense that it's a joy to perform, but it is audience facing. And so at the end of the day, there is this consideration with a lot of clown work that like the audience is as much a part of it as you are, right? And how do you keep the circuit alive of like, I'm seeing you, you're seeing me right back, right? That we're not pretending I'm elsewhere. Here we are right here with the idiot. So I think it is, yeah, we require students to have at least a little bit of prior training or experience. But I don't know. It's one of the things I always request, because I teach pretty frequently with Crossroads Comedy. And one of the things that I request is every now and again, I say, can I have just a 101 class? Because I think there is so much to be gained, even by us as teachers, for like re-meeting it for the first time. You know, the way that a 101 student, like someone fresh out the door, like you're explaining, because some of those students, like, they just need to get out of their own way. And even in big, dumb fun with the people who have training or have been overtrained in whatever way. It's more about unlearning, right? So you get someone who's never learned and it's actually like, great, you're in exactly where you need to be. So I don't know. I mean, that's not foolproof. And the goal of like, are we here to provide an experience for a student that's just like lively and fun and something interesting for them to do with their afternoon or evening? Or are we training performers? Like there does have to be sort of a separate track for both of those, I feel.
I kind of want to go back a second because I was curious. You were talking about how your current show involves a lot of like absurdism and existentialism and things like that. What does that mean in improv? And then B, how do you get to that? How do you put that on stage? What's that process like?
Yeah, it's a lot of things. I mean, part of it is I think to not be afraid of silence and stillness. First and foremost, which sounds like, wow, that must be the most dull show possible. But I think to really return to like the absolutely ground rule fundamentals of just like being a body in a space and being here with another body. And if that turns on in the way that a performer like drops in and sees one another and locks in, that's an electrifying moment to see. So I think that's part of it, like the actual like existentialism, not even as a genre, but as an artistic experiment of just like, here we are, right? It sounds so simple when I say it aloud, but when you see it on stage, you can tell two people are like, holy shit, we're here and anything could happen, right? The willingness to step into that unknown together is it's electrifying. And then the absurdism part of it, I think, is in a weird way, it's almost like the extreme logical conclusion of like premise-based comedy, right? We trip over something that we say that we can't actually bear and then insist upon it. Just as an example, it was one of my favorite shows. Kristen was playing like, it was some like retired general. And I was playing the like kind of forgotten wife while the general's away from the wars. And it became very important that she know that I was a boat. This makes no human sense, right? That I'm a boat, right? And just the extended poetic metaphor of like, I am a boat. And like, I'm floating now, I might sink later. Like divers are exploring the wreckage of me, right? It doesn't make a logical sense, but it makes a poetic sense. Does this sound like, it sounds a little like bullshit when I'm saying it like a second time? It's like reheated improv always sounds a little strange the second time through. But yeah, to take something that's like, this can't subsist, and to insist on it so hard, I think that's part of the absurdism.
Do you allow the discovery of I'm a boat, or how do you even get to I'm a boat? Or do you push yourself towards, you know, gibberish or nonsense to make those discoveries and then invest in them? Like, is it pure exploration and discovery, or is a little bit, you have some techniques to get yourself into that space?
Yeah, I guess a bit of both. That, I think that example stays in my mind because it was such a surprise to me as well. Like we've all been in the game long enough. We know how to make a show go, right? You can always like lean on the things. We know how to put a show on. And that to me stands as an example of like, actually there was an integrity of like really tipping us into the unknown. And that's where we landed. And that's where we held on to. And it was, I think, maybe one of our finest for the sincerity of that risk. We do tend to play, there is a pretty durable structure around it. We talk about, we usually ask for someone's dream or nightmare recently, and then we pick it apart to just get to the real, like, human existential anxiety. Like, what's really under there? What are we really talking about, right? What are we actually afraid of? And so frequently those are like archetypical things. The most recent show we did was, I think, last March. Kristen was in Philadelphia, and we did a show that was a mother and a daughter. and like sort of the end of life care question of like, is this daughter going to stay and care for the increasingly abusive mother, or are they going to like bail and go do their own life? And I think that was a much more like narratively driven one. We had like, yeah, moments of kind of like dreamlike movement. We had other characters that would pepper in and pepper out and kind of, if you're familiar with Godot, like when Lucky comes on the stage and goes, like, it's like, what the hell was that? Like, so little allusions to that sort of thing as well. But I don't know. It's the structure has always felt, part of it is like the joy of playing with Kristen Scheer, who is such a versatile and accomplished performer. There is no performance language that she cannot like immediately just shift into. So she's an inspiration just to play with and try and keep up with in that way. But yeah, I don't know the actual absurdism. There's rules we have. There's rules we play with, like to avoid proper nouns, right? Like we can be in the garden, but not like Rittenhouse Square, right? We can be, I don't know if there are other examples of that, but trying to keep it like a little bit universal, just so people can see themselves inside of it. Like we'll be known as like mother and father rather than like, you know, Susan and Dave, right? Like just to keep it a little bit othered in its own way.
That's cool. Is that something that you do for a lot of your projects, kind of like generate an internal rule list or some sort of like style guide for what you're going for?
Yeah. I think it's almost exclusive now. There's very few shows that I feel like I'll do that are just like, let's like pick it up and play, you know, just like those are fun, like to pick up and jam. But I like having a little bit of a target. And part of it is like, yeah, to really keep it fresh for ourselves. I think it's good for us to say like, this I've never done, or like, I don't know if this can be done. I've never seen anyone do this. What if we strive to it? What if we try? So yeah, the show that just closed a few weeks ago, Sam mentioned, was called Todorov's Dirty Laundry, and it was improvised tragedy, right? Just like modern tragedy, not like Greek tragedy. But the goal was, and this was maybe a smaller artistic risk, but like, can it be an hour of pure narrative? Like no, like just like one story, and can we make an audience cry? I think we got close. I mean, we made ourselves cry. We definitely had like moments of like, you know, acting choices where people were like opened up into those vulnerable, beautiful moments that we see in theater often, in improv, not too frequently. But it was, yeah. So for that, I think it worked. Do we make an audience cry? I don't know if we got there. I don't know. But yeah, that also had like style guide and consideration and like things that are like above board and not above board. And certainly when we're playing with tragedy, it opens the whole field of like, okay, are there stories we are not going to, we're going to say these aren't for sale, right? Like that's, I think there was a lot of conversation around, different content considerations as well. Yeah. So yeah, always a particularity.
But I don't know. It's not improvised Arthur Miller, right? Which I think you see a lot of with those sort of like improvised shows. It's more of sort of almost starting from the theater side of it and saying we're going to create a tragedy and then sort of like backing into it's just going to happen to be improvised. Is maybe how I'm hearing you're thinking about it in some ways, that it's just different from a lot of improv shows, I think, where they're more, I want to do the improv version of something, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there are some that are like, you know, genre driven in that way. Drama or tragedy is like almost a little too wide to contain, but part of it was just the shape of the ensemble kind of dictated the type of stories we were going to tell. Yeah. So, I mean, it would be, yeah, I'm trying to think. We had a run of 7 shows and each one was like, you know, particular in its own improvised way. There were some commonalities though. There were some, I think like the way we like to tell stories or the way we like center certain characters, mm-hmm. certain, yeah, themes of like the tragedy of like, infidelity or like different abuses of power. Like those things came up more than once across. And I think that's, yeah, just whatever's hot and fresh and in the minds of the ensemble. But that was less of a, like, we're going to improvise like Jane Austen, you know, like it was less stylistic in that way.
Mm-hmm. You have a run of 7 shows. It's being promoted that way. This is like a piece. This is like, come see this show. It's marketed that way and it's rehearsed that way. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah. Yeah. And actually we had a, this is maybe the problem of being a little bit on the outside of the genre. So this was part of the Fringe Festival in Philadelphia. That Fringe Arts made us choose to say, oh, we're comedy / improv, rather than we could have said like, this is theater. But yeah, we spent a lot of time at the outset of the show. There's like a projector and it's the author is sitting at a typewriter and you're seeing what's being typed and it's saying like, if you're here to see improv comedy, I have tragic news. So it was like trying to frame things honestly, like if people were coming to come see an improv show, just to let them know, like, this is a little bit different target than that. And yeah, the people who are coming to see theater knew like, yeah, this is, we are writing it right in front of you. I don't know if that answers your question though.
Yeah. It just, you know, all the things you're saying sound so delightful and so satisfying, especially to perform it. I'm not sure how great, I mean, I'm sure it's fun to watch as well, but you know, I perform more than watch. And I just am placing myself in that world. And it seems a little more, I don't know if the word is difficult to do here in LA, but it's like, you've mentioned a couple times the hour show, you know, a 2-person hour long. So you're not being sandwiched in the lineup of, you're not in between the Goof Around Gang and the musical improv group and you get 23 minutes. And like, that's kind of where I spend a lot of my time, is kind of in that world with lineups like that, do you know? And
I do,
so
yeah.
There's this kind of expectation from the audience. And, you know, I play with that and push that a little bit, but there's, yeah, this kind of expectation where I feel like the way you're talking about it feels like, if I got some grants to go to some art colony in like Connecticut and got to just riff with like artists versus here, you know, I've mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned on the podcast, but I've had some talks with some executives lately, some, I don't know if I need to name the companies, but you know, big TV show making companies, and like, they've been seeing a lot of clown shows lately. But even those clown shows are kind of flashy and poppy to not necessarily to appease the industry, but there is an industry here that's looking, you know, and like, I don't know what I'm just saying, I'm so interested in this and it sounds like something I would love to do, but I feel like it would just be like me and Jamie alone in a black box for one other person who might stumble into a show, rather than like,
yeah,
like your world seems to like be a little more conducive to this, this style of playing. I don't know if I'm making any sense, just kind of talking my thoughts here.
Yeah, no, it does sound like different ecosystems. And it makes me really curious about like the LA drivers, you know, like what are the reason people get on stage? I have, I think probably like unfair presumptions about like people in LA who take an improv class they're just like, they're trying to fast track their acting career and they've been told this. And I know very little just through like Chad Damiani as like a clown figure who pops into Philadelphia occasionally. And I follow the social media. The shows do seem, I think, poppy and like they know what they are. I believe that. Whether that's for like that's ultimately like some kind of ulterior, like let's get everyone on TV. No, it is. It's nice to hear, because I don't often think of it as like a luxury of Philadelphia. Is like, there's enough people to have a full audience. You know, they want to see stuff. There's enough people that you can, if you need 15 clowns, they're a phone call away. There's enough space that like, if you need an hour long show, like, yeah, like you're going to eat the costs. And if it's not, you know, GoFundMe, maybe it's grant funded, maybe it's self-produced, like, but it's possible. And that is You're right. I think in a way I might have been taking a lot of that for granted, that it's not every city gets the same things here that might be much more accessible or more affordable or just more doable in its own way here. I don't know. Because it is, yeah, you're right. It's like, is there room for experimental weird improv everywhere? I sure hope so. Yeah.
I mean, at the very least here, and Jamie is kind of at the forefront of that, the experimental improv, at the very least, we are seeing, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jamie, we are seeing some people looking in a different direction in improvisation rather than just being like looking backwards, like how do we get this right? How people have been doing it for the last, 30, 40 years. People are starting to get curious and starting to pop and explore a little bit like what that could be, which is nice. Then there is the clown scene that's pretty prevalent here, but we're still definitely in this exploratory phase where sometimes it's miss. And I don't just mean the content of the performances. That's fine if those miss. It's like, I don't know, the people who are coming to see it, it's difficult. Jamie can speak to it more because he's does it more often than I do, but it's funky, it's weird. But on the other hand, the last thing I'll say before Jamie can jump in, there is this weird thing, Nick, and I don't think Chad or anybody, I don't know their motives. I doubt that it's all for television. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I believe that they have pure intentions, but we are in Los Angeles. And there is this cool little like lottery ticket situation here where like you could pop, that could be the thing. And that puts you on a bigger map, which is really exciting. You know, it isn't why we do it, but it's there, the right person, you know, the story, how that goes. And that's kind of interesting too. But navigating this to get there has been interesting. I always tell Jamie, I always wanted him to be more like pop punk, not just the punk, which is just like for us, but a little bit of a packaging there that seems that an audience can take in, and maybe an audience that isn't trained to see this type of work. I've gone on too long. Please, Jamie.
No, I've been thinking a lot about it. You know, Liam and I just had a show last night at the West Side, which is, a traditional improv stand-up kind of scene. And we were sandwiched between, musical improv and like Chicago heavy hitters that are super funny, classic, good improv. And Liam and I do, weird stuff, which is fun and exciting for us. And when we did it 2 weeks ago, it's like, oh, I don't know if this is reading to the audience, who's in this audience. Chris was in the audience with some people. It was kind of an interesting, weird situation. And so last night, after the show, Liam and I were in the alleyway talking about the show and talking about whatever. And this lady and her husband come out, and she was a English British tourist who was just in Santa Monica for 2 days, never done improv in her life, doesn't know anything about improv. They just came because they wanted some comedy on a Monday night. And she's like, talking about our weird show. It's like, that was the funniest thing. My husband was going crazy laughing. And so it was like, it was freaking me out. I'm like, I thought like our show was so experimental and weird. And that was like for the improvisers who know that like what we're doing is pushing the buttons of improv and of theater and messing with all these, technical theatrical devices. But here's two people who have never done theater or improv in their life. And it told us how much they loved it. So it's like, it totally threw off my barometer. I have no idea what I'm doing anymore after this. Cause I'm like, I thought what I was doing is aiming towards like the improviser, the inside baseball, people who know what I'm doing, people who can see those moves and appreciate the nuance of what's happening. But also these British tourists who don't know anything love the show, which is great. But I'm also like, I don't know. It totally threw me off. So like in the best way, I have no idea what I'm doing.
Oh yeah. I get the feeling. It's funny. I'm kind of curious. Like your ideal audience, would it be like, is your ideal audience like the British tourists who are like, they don't know what they're in for, they're ready for anything? Or do you want the improvisers who are like, oh, this is real sharp, I know it's like there's musicology behind this, I'm really getting geeked out on, like, I don't know, but which would you prefer if you could only have one or the other?
I mean, that's the thing, is as I've matured, it's what Chris was just saying. It's like, I used to be super punk, like break everything, whatever, get into it. I don't care if nobody's in the audience. This show's for nobody. And now I'm like, oh, I want to have my cake and eat it too. I want the challenge of having every single person in that audience, maybe they appreciate it in different ways because they have different lenses, but everybody can appreciate what we're doing. And so, yeah, last night was interesting because I definitely didn't think it was something that, you know, non-theatrical people would enjoy, but apparently that was not the case. So my ideal audience is everybody in the room. You know, that's kind of, I want to, but also me, like, I want to do stuff that satisfies me. I don't want to pander to the audience. I want to do me, but also bring them in on it, which has been the challenge of finding that balance of, you know, I guess finding my voice, but also speaking in a language that the audience can understand.
Yeah. Like, I want to get my rocks off, but also I want to acknowledge theater as a public service. Right. Like, and those might not be like the things that really get my rocks off. I agree with the, like, you might be playing to very few people, right? Like, there might be very few people that actually are like on your exact trip. So yeah, that's, it's funny. It's like, there is stuff that's so experimental and out there that it's not even enjoyable anymore. You know, like, I think there's a line that after which, like, you have to recognize, like, okay, the experiment has concluded and there's data coming back. And then how do you refeed that into your process? Like, yeah, to pander to an audience is one thing, but to serve an audience and treat them with respect. I think I've seen shows where it's like, I don't even think the performer wants to be in this. Right? Like this is beyond and beyond. It's like they're apologizing for it as they're performing. It's too out there. It's too out there. No one wants this. No one loves it. But there ought to have been somewhere in the process, someone to say, like, hey, let's rein it in a little bit. Or, like, you know, let's touch the ground floor and kind of have a better idea of why the hell we're doing this in the first place. Which, I mean, for a lot of improvisers, I think even like at our level, like, we're making new, bold, interesting decisions with what we even consider improv. Like, I think we all just want to be funny, right? Like, I think there is something at the bottom of it. Like, we just want an audience to erupt, whether they are laughing or cheering.
But you said,
I don't know. Maybe that's
Nick. You said in the middle of the bad show you're referencing, nobody wants this, nobody loves it. And I think that's a big takeaway for me during this conversation is it sounds like you love it. And I know Jamie loves it. And I think no matter what you're doing, be it improvised tragedy or whatever, even if it's a little more experimental, if I can see that they love it, at the very least, I'm here, I'm engaged. You know, it might not be my cup of tea, but there are people who are just doing their impression of long form improvisation who don't love it, who maybe love watching it or love being a part of it, but are not loving it in that scene, right? They're so worried about getting stuff right. So I like, you know, obviously the experimental and the funky, and I love drama and I want to cry and bleed on stage all the time. But every time you've mentioned these shows, and Nick, that you've been a part of, I can imagine you and your cast loving what you're doing. And I think that is like huge, huge.
Yeah. It's I think it has to be. There was a friend of mine who, he was an actor in Philadelphia. He moved to Colorado. He was back just this weekend. And we went to see like a dance theater piece. And neither he or I are real like dance theater types. And we had a great conversation afterwards. And part of it was about there's like this unmonetizability of live theater, right? Like, you can really, even at the highest level, only pack so many bodies into a room. Right. You can only tour at the highest level to so many locations. There is a way that it just doesn't square the circle on like making it the full, like, our bread is earned solely from our work on the stage. Like, it's actually a very difficult uphill climb. And only at the very highest levels is it like you even considered like a sensible and stable career. So I think people get into it because of other things and what you've described, that like the love of the game, you know. I think that's always at the, you know, the fuel in the engine in a lot of ways. That, you know, if we're not making bank off of it, what are we making? And hopefully it's something that is pleasing to us in different ways, if it's not like the size of the paycheck at the end, you know.
Sure. I want Sam to talk, because Sam, you're on this podcast, right?
Yeah, I've been here the whole time.
Okay, cool. It's funny when you said what would be your ideal audience, Now, I've never even seen them, but I have an idea that my ideal audience would be the improvised Shakespeare audience. You know, some people there for the magic trick of it all, some there for the improv of it all, some of there for the theatricality of it all. Like, you know, there's a little bit of, it's a kind of a, and you don't have to like know the rules of a Herald to enjoy that show. And yet they, you know, they sell out shows and in theaters across the country. That sounds like a dream scenario with a dream audience.
Yeah. I mean, talk about people who probably really love what they're doing, right? And you can see it every minute. And in fact, they enjoy it so much, they can get people like Patrick Stewart, who doesn't really have like an improv background, to come in and do shows with them, which I think is really very cool, right? I mean, that's a little bit of that pop punk in some ways. I think Philly is a really cool town because you do get a lot of like patriots who are here for the love of it and not like mercenaries who are trying to get their paycheck out of it. But there's a balance there. And, you know, part of that balance there, Nick, is like there aren't maybe as many performance opportunities as a New York or an LA, Chicago. Like you do have to maybe produce your own show a little bit more. And I was wondering if you could maybe just sort of like comment a bit on your experience as a director, producer, and actually, this wasn't where I was starting, but I have been wanting to ask you about this. You performed in Todorov, but you were also sort of the director and producer, and you cast that group. And, you know, there's a little bit of a tension there between being on the outside and playing in. So can you just talk a little bit about like how you navigate that and sort of like just producing shows in general?
Yeah, well, I'll speak to that last bit first. It is a balance, and it's I think it was one of the things that we learned was possible at the Pig Iron School, was that like you can be in it and outside of it. And in fact, one of the biggest errors I made during that schooling was like my final project. I was like, I'll just be out of it. And this entire piece that I built with a role that was like really is me and I wish I were in it, I'm going to cast my friend in that so that I can have an outside look at it. And that was like, you know, worked, but also the lesson that I learned from it was like, oh no, it's possible, right? It's not easy, but it's possible to be inside and out. It does take a lot of clarity with the cast of like, when am I wearing the director's hat and giving notes and feedback? How do I note myself in a way that also feels like fair? How do we open up the room? Because I can't see everything, to encourage and validate the other voices of like, how do we have a culture where we can note each other that doesn't feel like snipey or mean or egotistical or like, just because this character, I didn't like that exact thing. But yeah, there was a balance, and part of it was just like straight up clarity at the top, like saying like, everyone's on the bus, I'm driving the bus, right? Like as a lead artist, like, I want everyone's inputs. Some decisions are going to be total like consensus. Like we'll debate until we find like the right thing. Some are that like full community. We all have one voice. Some of them are more like, I will consult, right? Like I want to hear your input and the final decision will land with me, right? So I think just being really clear about kind of what mode we were in takes a lot of the friction away, right? If we know what to expect from the decision-making process. And yeah, there's a weird like, okay, I'm the director, but also inside of it. Am I directing from the inside? I'm doing my best not to. One of the tools that I found really helpful was there's a book by Asaf Ronan, Directing Improv. And there's a whole chapter about like, is this even possible? Is it good to do? Like, what are the foibles and pitfalls? I got a lot of, I think, a lot of head start not tripping over my feet by reading that first and kind of understanding. Yeah, like just the clarity, I think, goes a long way, because it's not your typical improv setup with like, you know, here's the coach or director and here's the ensemble. And those roles are very clear. And we also have luxury of someone from the outside at all times. So yeah, challenging. Yeah, impossible. Far from it. I think it actually, I mean, part of it is, like Jamie was saying, like to play is part of it, you know, like that's a huge, like us being on stage, like it's one of the reasons we're in it, is because it's one of the best feelings in the world, just being that like live on the tip of everything, you know, at your wit's end, trying to pull the whole plot together and like keep an eye out, juggling, it feels like every choice until it exactly lands where it needs to.
I actually was messing around this morning. I sent Jamie and Liam a video with an idea. You know, what if there's a live direct from the inside during a show? You know, and I don't mean like stop it, like totally like putting on a director's hat, but is there a way to, well, there is a way, obviously, but I think there'd be something fun about that, like seeing that live direct happen internally, making those, and you kind of do that now, Jamie. You'll be in the middle of a scene and go, nah, not for me, or, you know.
Well, I have been thinking a lot about commitment, and I've actually, going on stage last night, I'm like, no, I don't care how bad it is. I don't care if I hate what I'm doing. I'm just going to commit harder to it. And you know what? It fucking worked. There were actually three poignant moments last time. Like, oh, I don't like what's happening. This isn't good. The audience doesn't like it. Neither do I. Nobody's feeling this. And then I just went in harder. And then we ended up pushing through and then coming out on the other side. And that always led to something else. So I have such mixed feelings between committing versus abandoning specific choices. And you know, I'm not sure, Nick, if you know John Davison, clown from London. We had him on last week.
Sam, did you take a workshop with him, or was that the same?
Yeah, it's the same guy.
Okay, yeah, I have heard of him through Sam, yes.
Yeah, I asked him this question, and he's basically saying, well, whatever the audience wants. You know, sometimes the audience wants you to commit to your thing, and sometimes the audience wasn't really on board anyway, so you're feel free to abandon it. I'm like, it's so simple, but that was exactly right. And it's frustrating how simple that advice was, because I want like a clear rule in my head. Like when I'm performing, I just know I'm just going to commit hard to everything. It's like, well, sometimes committing is the wrong choice because nobody liked what you were doing in the first place. And so maybe just farewell to that and move on to something else. So
Nick, I have a broader question that there might be some negativity in there, because I'm kind of a bit of a hater, a self-proclaimed hater. You know, I get jealous easily, and I want to do that and this, or why aren't I on Improvised Shakespeare? But do you get any, is there any feeling being in kind of a, not that Philly is a small market, but a smaller-ish improv performance market, do you feel any kind of way about Los Angeles, Chicago improv, right? New York, the UCB stuff. Do you feel like you're ever missing out, or you wonder how you might fare? I don't know if the word is against, but let's just say like with those particular communities, do you have a desire to be a part of them? Are you glad you're not? What's your kind of general feelings about that stuff?
That's such a good question. I do have feels about it. And part of it is like the false story I'll tell myself, like, they don't fucking know a thing, right? They all have sticks up their asses. And really what I'm talking about is me, right? I have a stick up my ass about these things. But it's part of it is like an acknowledgement and an acceptance. Like I have a home and a family and two beautiful children here. Like I'm a Philadelphian, right? And the reason I left my last company is because like the touring got too intense, right? So there's a little chip on my shoulder that's like, no, I was this close to like making it, right? And then decided to that if I wanted to be the father that I imagined myself to be, that I had to step away from that and be more present at home. And so that does keep my eyes a little bit right on the floor of where I am. You know, it's comparison is its own like just poison tree. You know, there's always going to be better work. I'm never going to be the best improviser in the world. I think I could maybe with like another 20 years of hard work be the best improviser in Philadelphia, right? Like you'll start small, but I don't know. I do the comparison dance more because I know more about the like schooling styles of New York and Chicago and then particularly like LA. I don't know if there's a particular like school I associate with it or style even. But yeah, I think there's enough things in Philadelphia that need attention. And part of it is like the quality of improv is lower. Like, and that's, I'm going to walk those words back at some point, but like, I think your average show in New York or in Chicago or in LA your average show is going to be pretty fucking funny. Mm. And your average show in Philadelphia is going to be like pretty funny. Mm. You know what I mean? Like there's, I don't know if that's a fair assessment. Again, I don't get to travel too often. But whenever we bring in acts from like New York and they'll play it like Crossroads Comedy, I'll see them and be like, yeah, it is that easy. What the hell have we been doing? Right? Like, why isn't everyone like playing in this way? This isn't hard. We teach this. Why don't we do it? Right. So to me, there's a little bit of a, it's a smaller goal, like about like, let me lift up the scene of Philadelphia. Part of that is just the physics of I'm here. I got to be here, you know? And part of it is like a willingness to both learn from elsewhere and to not sweat it too hard when it's different. Yeah. You know?
I think the best players in Los Angeles, New York, or Chicago are just like the best players in Philadelphia. I think, you know what I mean? Like at the end of the day, there's a lot of bad improv in all of those places. and I don't need to shit on them. I do that for myself to make myself feel better, but let's be honest. There's a lot of fucking bad improv in Los Angeles. I see it constantly. And listen, I've been that LA team that goes to that festival and fucking breaks those brains apart. Do you know what I mean? Everyone's like, what the fuck? But I imagine you're doing that, Nick, with what you said earlier about that show with Kristen. Like that, I don't know, man. I mean, you said it best. I don't have to wrap this up for you, but I think we're all doing just fine. Thanks, everybody. That's my time. I'm done. I don't know what I'm saying anymore.
That's all good. Hold on a sec. My kids just came back from grandma's. I'm going to shut the door real quick.
Hey, kiddos. I'm still recording. Can I ask you to be a little quiet?
Sam, on the way out here, I mean, Nick's kids are home. Come on. We can't be here all day.
Can't be here forever.
I mean, you have spent time in both of the markets, LA, Philly. You only have, every time we talk, you only have positive things to say about Philly and the people and the work and stuff. But, you know, is there anything you want to kind of mention as a big difference, something that you don't miss about LA or you do miss or anything like that?
No, I think like what you said earlier about like there's good improv and bad improv everywhere is like really true. And I say that kind of after visiting Chicago over the summer, I was both pleasantly surprised that some shows were wildly successful and some like really great improv. And then at the same time, I was like somewhat encouraged that like some of the shows weren't all like fantastic always, right? Like we're all humans. We all have good shows. We all have bad shows. We all have different sort of like training. And I'll tell you the one thing, we had a cage match last night at a place called Tattooed Mom, which is this really cool bar. There's like a back area that has like bumper cars and like stickers are everywhere. It's a really fun like venue. And my new favorite thing now is to like walk into something and get the audience to go like, whoa. And like, no. Like, I didn't mean it that way. Right. And like, there's so many different audience reactions. And sometimes you stumble into that one where like, they're all against you for a second. You're like, hold on a second. Like, you're misunderstanding me. I didn't mean it that way. And so that was fun. We won the cage match, which was exciting.
This is what improv's all about. It's a competition, dog. Competition. You know what I mean? And you gotta be better.
Yeah, Schmoody won the title. Tattooed Mom's Invitational. I saw some of the photos. It looks like it was a rad show.
That was fun.
We're gonna let you go, Nick. But I mean, we could talk to you for hours, obviously. Any last thing, any points you want to make or something, or you can even promote or whatever you want. I know we had a little internet mess up and your kids came home. I just want to make sure that you've wrapped up your thoughts the way you want to.
Well, first off, just that it's been such a fantastic, pleasant conversation. I think talking to the three of you is it's just nice to hear the these thoughtful questions and know that people are like out there on the other side of the country, like pushing the boundaries in the same way. As far as plugs go, Sam Miller and me are two-thirds of a trio that's playing on October 25th at Plays and Players, part of Crossroads Comedy. Come out. It's called Das Team. It's almost a guaranteed good time. We were talking about the quality of improv in Philadelphia, and I think Das Team just like – we jacked it up. We're ruining the curve on everyone. Just it's too good.
Rising the tide.
Yeah, all boats with the rising tide. Yeah. But no, it's a joy to play with Sam always, and it's a wonderful joy to talk to both of you. I can't wait to see more of this Jamie and Liam show. I bring it to Philadelphia, please.
Well, if they tour, I got to be a part of the show. I like this slogan on the way out here. DOS team, it's almost a guaranteed good time.
Almost, yeah. Yeah, if it weren't guaranteed, you'd be like, I don't know if this is improvised. Hold on a second. You gotta have a good 96% hit rate. Otherwise, people think it's scripted, yeah. Right?
And there's probably not, but is there any footage of you and Kristen performing? Is there any Instagram little videos or YouTube links or anything? Is there somewhere we could find that?
Yeah. There are some full shows we have. I'll say the production footage is kind of like archival. Like, it's not a well tailored video. And the most recent one was actually the last time we were in Vancouver in 2019. Part of the show we did, and this was like an experiment we played with a little bit, was we would live stream the show from a phone, and a third person would be like moving it around and like really get, we encourage them to like play with, and we're projecting the live screen behind us. So there's this like infinity loop of like, it's the whole show. You see like 3 seconds behind and 3 seconds behind and 3 seconds behind. So there's this weird feedback loop happening as we're like, you know, stuck somewhere, you know? And then also to edit the show, one of the final buttons is they unmute the live stream. So the last thing we said gets picked up by the camera, and then you hear it in the PA, and that gets picked up by the camera, and it's on the live stream. And so it starts like echoing in those like weird feedback loop ways. So the video footage is from that phone. It's not a traditional, like, this is what it looks like from the audience, but I'll be happy to send you the links that we have, and some of the more like, this is us on stage, and you can kind of like perceive what's happening all throughout.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that one sounds insane, but I'm kind of into it. And I think just for myself, and I know our listeners, I want to see a little bit. I want to taste a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I'll get those links to you.
Appreciate it. Well, thank you so much, Nick. Dude, this has been a blast.
Oh, likewise. Yeah, no, my pleasure. Anytime. Yeah.